Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the January 16th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. And you can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here across the table. He's an economist. He's the author of the book Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life, the host of the Capital Record podcast, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. Good to be with you. Are you working full time these days?
Always. More than as much full time as I can get. And I know you do too.
You know what? We spend a lot of time talking about on this show, and you are, I believe, one of the foremost experts on in not only California, but America, is the corrupting influence of public employee unions.
Yes.
You know that you cannot really have a sensible, grown up economic conversation about work without pointing out the corrupting influence of the unions. In this sense,
go on.
If I say, do you work full time this week? How many people do you think would answer that in the context of, well, yes, I work full time. Mm-hmm. I worked over 40 hours.
Right. The majority.
Where did that come from?
1930s?
Department of Labor and the unions.
Yeah.
Where in the world do we get the idea of 40 hours as a full-time worker?
Well, and now, of course, I think you mentioned this a few weeks ago, the big push is to drop that dramatically because more leisure time leads, the argument goes, to greater mental health.
No, that's true. I had to be careful in this conversation because you bring up an important point. There is a movement to fix this. It's to get it down to 24 hours.
That's right.
And even the 52 weeks in a year, I think there's people that wanted it like 40 weeks, about mm-hmm. 12 weeks of a mm-hmm. siesta.
That's right.
I used to think people said siesta were saying fiesta and that they had a lisp. Like they didn't know how to talk.
They were from Barcelona.
No, yeah, they're saying something like something was off. I didn't realize it was a thing.
Hey, the book is a born. Congratulations. It looks lovely. And for that reason, you will be traveling an awful lot over the next, couple of months, I think, really, and out of the office here, at least out of the studio.
Yeah, there's a lot where I will have to be out of the studio, but I'm actually, for certain weeks, even out of the New York office, because there are a lot of speaking engagements and things around the book. But look, Will, the more I'm traveling outside California, the more my taxes are going down, and that doesn't matter what state I'm going to. This is the funniest thing people talk about in New York. They need to realize that California is in first place in every category of badness.
Yes.
They're like you say, it's outrageous that people pay 12.9% state income tax at the top rate in New York. First of all, they don't. They pay 12.9% if they're a New York State resident who lives in Manhattan. Mm. 2-point-something percent of that
is
a city tax.
Yes.
Yeah. But even with the Manhattan tax, you are 40 basis points away of getting to what California charges everyone on the top rate. But there's a whole lot of other issues as well that make, I think, in on the margin, California the most poorly governed state in the country.
What's fascinating is despite the fact that this is just kind of warm up and good to see you again kind of talk, because, you know, though we text one another frequently throughout each day and some of our friends, the fact is that everything we just described, we will explore in this particular episode of the show. If you'll forgive me for just a moment, I want to talk about the founding this week in 1887 of Chinatown, San Francisco, Chinatown Telephone Exchange. This goes back to a time, David, when you had to have people like, and older listeners will remember the images of this, at least, maybe even younger listeners, but you had to have these people sitting there and listening, and, you know, to somebody call in and say, I want to talk to, you know, this is Will, I want to talk to David, and they would plug the little cord into a hole in the wall that would link me to you. So in Chinatown in San Francisco, the challenge was a lot of immigrants did not speak English. And so the Chinatown Telephone Exchange, 1887, was designed to have a bunch of, I'm just going to say it, attractive women sit in a building with a glass storefront window, and they would speak, of course, fluent multi-dialect Chinese to each caller and connect them. There was a fascinating test these women had to pass. They had to know the names and phone numbers of every single person who spoke Chinese. So this would be anywhere from 4,500 to 6,000 people sometimes. And you had to pass this test before you could sit at the chair. And as they say, tourist bus used to roll around into Chinatown, and you know, including Chinese and other tourists, and they would pile out of the buses there and then walk up to the window and look at these women dressed at first in sort of, let's call it Chinese traditional wear. And they would just watch these elegant women just work busily doing their work. Of course, they are replaced by the 1940s by the development of the rotary telephone, invoke Schumpeter here. And these call centers go away. But David, you know, I just thought that this was such a fascinating story, and we could go on. We could have an entire episode just about this element, about hard work, full-time work. Talk about full-time. These people, the managers of this system, lived in the building above the call center so that they could just take shifts. They, you know, they basically warm bunked upstairs and then came downstairs to manage these women who were had replaced men, actually. I should have pointed that out. In the very earliest weeks of this thing, or years, I guess, men did this this operation, performed this function, but men, it turned out, were too short-tempered, and I'm not talking about Chinese men, I'm talking about men in general, too short-tempered to manage the stress and the difficult callers, and so they brought in...
That's totally ridiculous! God, that's offensive.
I agree with you. And there it is, the Chinatown Telephone Exchange, 1887 to sometime in the 1940s, all gone.
Hey, by the way, what a great piece of history. And interesting, I wonder where that immigration angle would play today. Would people be like supportive of this story, or would they view it as a net negative?
That's a great question, because it is what the sociologists like to call multivalent. And that is that some folks just don't want any immigration at all. Others are, let's open the borders and let all comers come.
I think there's very few on that second category.
Really?
Well,
I think Governor Gavin Newsom in the sanctuary state of California.
No, I don't. I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so. No, I think that there's some that do want that, like a full-blown open border, and then I think there's some that say they want it. The politics of that has changed a lot in the last like 6 to 12 months.
Yes.
And the migrant thing and stuff. I think there's a pendulum shift there. But I've always believed, I think you know, I wrote a chapter in Crisis of Responsibility about this, that there's a lot of misguided angst on this, where people think they're against something and really they're against the multiculturalism and lack of assimilation. And I wonder if the assimilation of Chinese immigration in San Francisco and the process that you speak of would have pacified the nativist.
At the time, it was quite clearly a problem. And you can understand that when it comes to government function, it becomes more problematic. You know, printing ballots in 100-plus languages. One begins to wonder how much people can really be informed about politics. Maybe they're more informed because they're not on Twitter. But I take your point. Immigration is a really interesting issue that shifts depending on the individual's, I don't know, own. You know, we have businesses in the United States that love, they thrive on low-income immigrants to do, you know, farm work, just as a for instance. And the UFW, United Farm Workers, of course, profits mightily off claiming that those people are terribly exploited, but does nothing to go down to the border and shout at them, don't come, go back home, this place is terrible for you. So, what do you think?
I don't know. I think that it's a mixed bag. I think that there is not a monolithic side that would be considered pro-immigration and a monolithic that would be considered anti-immigration. Because I don't. There's a lot of areas where I sometimes feel like I am the only one in the world with a certain set of nuances. And really what I mean is you and me and like 50 other people of our remnant. And right now, the biggest thing I'm looking for in the remnant, like just the kind of idiosyncratic very iconoclastic young group of rebels is just principled people. Mm-hmm. That's like all I'm after. Mm-hmm. I think it's like down to about 50, you know, that are conservative in ideology, as opposed to just having a sort of populist temperament. In this subject with immigration, I think there's a lot of nuanced people. And I think that there are pro-immigration people that sound anti-immigration, and there are anti-immigration people that sound pro-immigration, again, around that issue of assimilation. I could be made to sound very anti-immigration, where I consider myself wildly and almost radically pro-immigration. Mm-hmm. It's just that I want to tether a really robust sense of bringing more workers in. And there are people who say, like, we have to stop that because we can't afford all of these new people coming and pushing wages down. And mm-hmm. I have a very different economic understanding of how the addition of a producer who is also a consumer mm-hmm. impacts economic headcount. My issue is I just believe immigrants should become Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we should have English language, and I think we should have some degree of civics understanding mm-hmm. and whatnot, certain commitments. So in that way, I think you could call me an Ellis Island immigrationist. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really good idea. But no, I think that there's people all over the map on this issue today.
Well, there is the challenge in the U.S. that a lot of the immigrants coming across the border today are protected, let's say, or fenced in by special interest groups who do not want them well integrated into the founding principles of the United States. And I think that's a problem for the country. We have a considerable number of people, who are native born and who know nothing about, you and I have talked about this before, G.K. Chesterton, you reminded me, who famously says, if you want to know why, if you want to tear down a fence, it's best to understand why it was put there in the first place. These founding principles are a kind of fence. They are built on thousands of years of studying humanity and our natural inclinations. But I don't see that changing if, in fact, native-born people get into our schools and are never, ever, ever taught this. You can make it all the way through university without ever having picked up the, a Federalist paper, let alone the Federalist Papers. So I think this is our big challenge, that it is a challenge. It's a challenge to America and the things that made this country such a magnet for immigration to this minute. That we don't understand, many of us, how it got this way. So, David, you and I are recording this the morning after the Iowa caucus, and I'm wondering, what did you make of the events last night? I know this is not strictly
speaking. I'll have more feedback on this when we get the final results. I mean, right now, it's just up in the air, You know what's interesting? I think that there's a lot of little subplots to it. You know who's a real donkey's ass is Vivek Ramaswamy.
Yeah.
I do, it's funny, National Review, I don't know if you noticed it, internally within a kind of Twitter thread or something, had a kind of interesting internal fight last night, because there were some, including one of the most profoundly intelligent political commentators that the world has ever seen, and my friend Dan McGoffin at National Review, really piping hot mad. Noah Rothman was with Dan on this, against them announcing who had won.
Mm.
Before the votes were, were cast.
Right.
Just a little odd, And a guy who's an equally brilliant, younger, but just real brilliant guy at National Review named Dominic Pino came back to say, come on, we knew. They're not saying this is what the votes are going to be. They're not saying a margin. They're saying we are able
to project.
To project. And sometimes that's all it takes is the combination of pretextual circumstances with the first four votes, and then you're like, okay, we got this. And I'm not sure that he's wrong empirically, but I do think Dominic's wrong in terms of what the intent of it is. When caucus, because the margins matter, first of all, it's proportional, right? Mm-hmm. And as a journalist, they have their own standards. They're not supposed to report in a way that will impact the final vote. But the delegates are proportional. So if you're sitting in the snow, it's 8 below, you haven't voted yet, and your phone card starts popping off, they've given it to Trump. I do know that there are people who didn't vote that otherwise would have voted. Now, Trump won by 30 points. He won by a little less than the polls indicated, by about 5 or 6 percentage points, I should add. But again, that's irrelevant. When you get 52 to, whatever it was, 29 or something.
I think it was 21.
A win. A win. It was a big, big win. My point is, the concept of it, even if the numbers ended up panning out to that degree, I really don't like the media putting their thumb on the scale early in the evening. I think it's anti-democratic, even if it isn't outside the bounds of predictive, you know, allowance. Yeah, so obviously, you know, DeSantis' strategy, either DeSantis is done and he waits around just to kind of, you know, kind of throw some elbows, or he waits around to be in a pole position should Trump completely fall, either on the next Big Mac or on the next court ruling. and I think that with Nikki Haley, she obviously would need to win in New Hampshire to kind of stay alive. I indicted myself a little on Twitter last night because I did do this. So, like, it was preposterous what Nikki said. But I I'm not a candidate who's saying it. But in 2016, Marco Rubio came in third place in South Carolina. And I remember saying, like, Marco's the real leader tonight. Like, this is where you kind of want to be. Like, you know, when you're in third place, you're never like, okay, good. This is what I was at. But, like, Nikki specifically said, it's now clear it's a two-man race.
Mm.
And she was the one who came in third place. So I think spin and whatnot, everybody kind of does.
I'm sorry,
it.
Did she mean two-person race for second place?
Well, she didn't. She meant her and Trump, and that it was a two-man race because...
But she came in third.
Right, and so that was the preposterousness of it. Now, if you're being really, really gracious, what she could have meant is, I barely came in third, I was pretty close. Mm-hmm. And I do have a better chance in New Hampshire, so therefore it's a two-man race if you look ahead a little bit. Mm-hmm. But by her logic as to why it isn't a two-man race with the first and second place people, by her logic, it's not a two-man race at all, because what she's saying is, if you look ahead, I'm doing better in New Hampshire than DeSantis. Mm-hmm. But if you look ahead, Trump's doing better than you everywhere,
right.
So let's just end the whole thing now.
Sure.
Right? But that is pretty much where we are. I mean, more or less, it's pretty much over. Like, the electorate is with Trump.
Well, there was speaking of this, I'm going to jumble the run list here a wee bit and run to the LA Times story that I'm going to call remarkable, even though you and I talked about this months and months ago. The Times headline is, California could be Trump's ace in nomination fight. He's way ahead. Their point is that, and you and I discussed this part, the Republican Party in California changed its way of counting Republican votes in the primary so that it is winner take all. The system used to be that multitudes of candidates could flock into California, Republican and Democrat. But let's just talk about the Republicans here. Republican candidates could swarm into the state because we have the largest delegate count of any state in the union. Not a surprise. 169 delegates are at play. And it used to be that if you won a congressional district, you got three delegates out of that district. And that was an incentive for people to come. You know, you could have Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis showing up here on March 5th and hoping that they could just win a few of our congressional districts and collect some delegates. The GOP decided they were going to change that. And this was pushed by the Trump campaign. And that the new way is it's just winner take all. If you win the simple majority of the state, you win. You get all 169 delegates. And so Trump will actually, if he wins, and it looks that he's poised to do so, far more than 50% of Californians are ready to vote for the guy.
Republicans in California.
I'm sorry, that's what I mean. Thank you.
Which is like 29% of Californians now.
Yeah, that's right. But my point is only that Trump will walk away with 169 delegates rather than perhaps only half that amount. Yeah. So I think this is a significant story. The Times is really excited about it because I think they've just discovered this. But of course, this has been around now in the rules making problem for months.
Oh, more than months. It's been since 2020. This stuff's been moving in that direction, and Trump's people did a very good job. It just turns out in hindsight they didn't need to. To try to use rules as a strategy in some of the Super Tuesday and beyond states.
What did you make of, I don't know if you even paid attention to it, but Trump's speech last night seemed to hit, and I only read excerpts.
I'm sorry, actually.
Please, no, go ahead.
If he talked that way the rest of the campaign, he'd be the president.
I agree.
He just can't do it.
It was very temperate.
He can't do it.
Except for the fact
I've said this five different times since Donald Trump entered the stage down the escalator 2015. There were certain moments, it's not more than five, it could be less, three, four, five times where I said that's the tone and tenor that I know.
And describe
people would forgive, well, for just sounding like an adult.
Yes.
sounding like a gracious human being.
Yes.
This is considered a bug, not a feature, to a lot of his base when he talks this way. But what the people that consider themselves the most fanciful MAGA-ish people don't understand is if they really want their God to win, he can't win. Independents and moderates, if he doesn't act like a grown-up. But the amount of people that are willing to forgive 8 years of bad behavior if he could just like talk nice for a week, it's unbelievable. And the thing is, over and over again, he does it, you start going like, okay, I know the Democrats would be shaking if they thought he could just sort of talk mm-hmm. this way, behave mm-hmm. this way. Then all it takes is like one tweet from Tucker Carlson, like, where did our guy go? Why is he not, you know, calling Ron a like a P word or something? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And like Steve Bannon making fun of him on the mm-hmm, podcast. Mm-hmm. And then Trump just can't stick with it.
Right.
And it may, you know, in fairness, it may not just be the peer pressure of other Neanderthals. It might be Trump's lack of discipline and decorum himself.
I think that's part of it.
But I mean, there is no indication that he possesses the self-discipline to behave the way he did in the speech last night for greater than a 10-day period of time.
Yeah.
I will say this, for those who think I'm being hard on Trump right now. If Trump could behave that way from now till November, he will be the president.
Yeah. Well, the mainstream media helped him along with the one, you know, he did not reprise his claim of a couple of weeks ago when he suggested that Ron DeSantis had already, quote unquote, stole the Iowa caucuses. I don't know if that was just a prophylactic or what, but there it was. He just can't stop himself. And then last night, he, you know, just affirmed his stand on immigration, which I thought was fine. That was the most, I would argue, electrifying thing he said. Of course, the left went crazy and used it as more evidence of his racism. But he did repeat his claim that the 2020 election was stolen. And I just think, you know, again, feature versus bug. I think a lot of people on the left just regard that as, okay, I'm out, you know, or even in independents. I talked to a few independent, lean conservative voters last night afterward. And each one of them said, God, if he can't stop himself. He's got to talk about 2020. So, all right, let's...
Isn't it funny, the bar that has been set? That, like, Trump has basically spent most of his campaign calling Ron DeSantis a pedophile. And then last night he called him Ron instead of DeSantis. Mm. And there are people who are like, that's really nice.
That's a grown up.
He called him Ron. Like, yeah. That's a big jet. Yes. That's a real outreach.
Yeah.
You know,
so, you know, I maybe I should put it in the show notes. There's a great piece by Brett Stevens that a friend of ours sent us in the New York Times. And he was saying, look, I'm not voting for Trump. I oppose Trump. Brett Stevens, of course, is famously conservative. But then he went in to say, look, if you hope to defeat somebody, you better know why they work, you know, how they work, why they work. And Trump works on a variety of issues that the left just doesn't get at all. Immigration, the impact of illegal immigration on wages and salaries, particularly those who've been kind of left behind in 2020. I'm sorry, in the 2000s. And I think that, you know, a lot of these things are sort of the J.D. Vance, original J.D. Vance of Hillbilly Elegy, you know, is a kind of a thing that I think a lot of Americans, whether they are left or right, and especially Democrats and labor people, really are starting to get riled up about immigration. So I think Trump has this issue alone could just hammer Biden. Hey, let's talk about the other big news nationally, if we can. Just a couple of quick stories. Let's put this in the Kamala corner. This is a review of a new book. The book is called The Truce, Progressives, Centrists, and the Future of the Democratic Party by reporters Hunter Walker and Lupe Lupin. The book is going to come out next week, but The Guardian's already got a copy. And they say, boy, oh boy, does this pound Kamala Harris. Their headline is, quote, "This person should not be president. Kamala Harris takes hits in new book on Biden." Most of us are, you know, who talk about this and listen to this show, we all know that you know, these are the familiar claims. These are Harris's friends, her former staffers, frequently talking about what an execrable human being she is. And the headline of the Guardian story, the Guardian, of course, is a famously lefty newspaper out of the UK. But they really talk very candidly about the fact that they've got here one campaign aide quoted as saying she was rotten from the start. The same source said, a lot of us, at least folks I was friends with in the campaign, all realized, yeah, this person should not be president of the United States. It's you know, just kind of more of the same, but it is interesting to me that the drum beat continues. That it's not there, like there's a sudden shift. There was a one story we talked, I think, last week about the fact that Harris has really found her stride right now. Why? Because Hamas invaded and murdered and massacred and raped and executed civilians in southern Israel. And that has young progressives lit up. And Kamala's there to remind them that she's on their side because she's a person of color and a woman. But that's it. That's the one thing she has going for it. I'm not sure that works nationally. She doesn't poll any worse than Biden, but that's not saying a lot.
So I have a question for you and for listeners. What is a bigger liability to Joe Biden if you made it binary? His age or Kamala Harris? See, of course, before I stop talking, it isn't binary. Those two things are connected.
Right.
They overlap with one another because Kamala Harris becomes a bigger liability because of the other liability of his age. I think if Joe Biden was 58 and healthy, people would hate Kamala Harris but still be willing to vote for him. But what it is that the only person who can't have a VP this bad is someone who's 97 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. This issue.
So what Kamala should do is say, hey, it's not my fault everyone hates me.
Yeah.
It's your fault for being so old and almost dead. And then see how that goes over. That could sell the Atlantic.
I had my regular...
She's turning over a new leaf.
I had my regular check-in call with a few Newsom allies, folks who work somewhat close, quite close in one case, to the governor. And each one of them still believes the DNC is going to pull the trigger. They are going to push Kamala overboard somehow, bring Gavin Newsom in as VP, then Joe Biden's family is going to say, Joe, we really need you to spend more time with us. These are your sunset years, and you should be up on the coast there enjoying your grandchildren and your son Hunter's company before he's shackled up. And then Gavin Newsom steps in and runs as an incumbent. All of this, they claim, will happen sometime between now and, say, June, July. I still find that just such a long shot, but only because it's extraordinary. But what hasn't been extraordinary these last several years?
Well, I don't know that we should say that scenario is off the table when one of the conditions of the people making that prediction, which, as you know, I was always one of them, was that it would be at the point the Democrats knew Trump had sealed up the nomination.
Mm-hmm.
So if Biden is to make a health-oriented exit, I never thought it would be by now. I always thought it would be after they knew it was Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, the predicate to the belief is that once Trump's the nominee, they think a baked potato can win.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, Biden's health and liability as the riskiest candidate to run against Trump, they can address that issue at the point they know he's the nominee. And then I guess you could disagree. If my theory is wrong, it's almost for sure going to be wrong because Biden doesn't exit. But if Biden exits, does anyone believe it won't be Gavin Newsom?
Yeah, there are people who think that Gavin Newsom's popularity among swing state voters is really precarious. And some of the stuff we're going to talk about here in just a moment, particularly the budget crisis going on right now in the state of California, this does not bode well for him, nor does his stand on immigration. When you create a sanctuary state and you hand out free health insurance to people who are undocumented, and that comes at a cost of $5 billion per year, but you've got a budget crisis and you're not willing to throw that overboard, you got a challenge. What do you think?
I totally disagree with you.
Please.
You're talking the way it's supposed to be, not the way it is. You think because of his bad immigration policy, people would blame him. You don't think that handsome devil go on TV and blame the radicals of San Francisco? I think he'd sell him down the river in a second. And I think our stupid ass country would forget the next day what he did. And I don't mean our country. I mean the voters that would matter here, that they fall for spin all the time.
Yes. No, I agree with you. And yet he would have other competitors up there who are from states that have now finally awakened to the problem of
Will he have other competitors? Who else has been running a shadow campaign? She hasn't been running for president the last 6 months the way Gavin has.
Josh Shapiro's
not even close to running a shadow campaign. Whitmer is closer to it, but what has Gavin done in immigration that Whitmer hasn't done? I mean, I'll tell you this, Gavin's got more homeless, But Whitmer's got more, shall we say, Hamas.
Yeah, Hamas supporters.
Okay,
yeah.
So yeah. I don't think that either one of them, they're not going to start throwing mud at each other.
Well, more will be revealed. This is so much fun. All right, I want to talk about one more federal issue with a California resonance or echo here.
Oh, did
here.
You hear my favorite tweet last night? I'm sorry.
No, please.
All that has to happen now for Ron DeSantis to win is for Mike Pence to do the right thing.
Did you say that?
No, I retweeted someone else saying
Sorry, I missed that. That is good.
It was clever.
Here's the headline on the next story. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle. How the new Biden administration gig worker rule could impact California. Here's what's great, David. This is a story essentially about what we have talked about for years since its passage here. Assembly Bill 5, Lorena Gonzalez, her big piece of final kind of blast at California before she left the assembly was Assembly Bill 5. And that, of course, required independent contractors to become full employees in many cases of larger corporations. The goal then was that you could go after these larger corporations more easily than you can independent contractors and force them into unions. So that's AB 5 in a nutshell. It, of course, is now shot through with holes, both judicial and practical. Loads of exemptions here in the Golden State for some workers. It was originally aimed, of course, at Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash, other gig economy workers, but they fought back in 2020 with Prop. I always get this backward. Is it 2020 with Prop 22? Yes, that's when it was. And so Uber, Lyft, and others got themselves out of AB 5. But now the Biden administration's Department of Labor, with their acting secretary, former California Department of Labor Secretary Julie Hsu, are going to bring AB 5 national, which is always what we had warned people about. That what starts here does not stay here. So you've got this new Biden initiative is just really a rule. This is the problem of regulatory agencies in the United States of America and in California, that you have these massive, unaccountable regulatory agencies that simply just decide they're going to do a new thing. Congress is pushed to the side. The courts are almost dared to challenge them. And we've got a new bill, a new rule, rather, from the Biden Labor Department that will implement AB 5 nationwide. Let's just reprise real quickly that bill in California has eliminated, as independent contractors, about 600 different business types: wedding planners, photographers, graphic designers, etc. Translators have been troubled by this. So we've got tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of California workers, including about 70,000 independent truckers, all of whom no longer can work as independent business owners for reasons they chose. The reporting on this, I looked everywhere on this story, found every major newspaper that reported on it said that what this does is it makes it easier for the opposition, the opponents to AB 5 and to the federal law or federal rule say, well, this would make it much easier for businesses to classify workers as independent contractors. No, it makes classified workers free to classify themselves. So this is a very big distinction that the media simply does not understand. If I raise my hand and say, I want to be independent, I want to be an independent contractor, the federal government comes in and says, no, you can't. So this is terrible. Good old Kevin Kiley, congressman out of Placer County, Rockland to be specific. Kevin Kiley has introduced a bill that would absolutely shut down this bill. It'll be interesting to see how House Democrats and especially House Republicans go on this bill. But there it is. David, any thoughts about what starts in California doesn't stay here?
No, well, that's kind of the essence of our podcast.
Yeah. Gonzalez Fletcher told the Chronicle that she's delighted by this new Department of Labor law because it will prevent companies from shopping around to a different state with laxer rules. So here's the goal. You started in California, and when you press and you squeeze on these companies, they will simply go to red states. Hoping to head that off, we've got this new rule. Now, of course, any rule will be undone by the next president, or can be, I should say. And if that next president is Donald Trump, I believe that he will come in and simply write an executive order just eliminating this new rule.
Yeah.
Because it directly contradicts one of the great things that he did in office, which was to allow people to classify themselves as independents rather than full-time employees. All right, David, big news here on the budget, of course. We can make this super quick, but there's lots of numbers, which I know is for you, it's dessert as well as entree. But we've got Newsom now cock-a-doodling that he has handled the $68 billion deficit that showed up. He was shocked by this, shocked that this happened. But the Legislative Analyst's Office estimated the deficit at $68 billion. Here's how Newsom reduces that deficit. Step one, he got his own Department of Finance to produce a far sunnier forecast, and therefore he says the budget deficit is $30 billion less, totaling just $38 billion. Still an extraordinary amount of money for the state of California. But that's the first thing he did, was he just waved a wand and said, well, you know, we just have a difference of opinion in the short run versus long run. We're just a little less pessimistic than the LAO is about next year. So he says, oh, it's just a matter of interpretation. The LAO says, the Legislative Analyst Office says, no, there's no real
interpretation. Yeah, but here's the thing is, like, we run into this all the time with CBO projections too. And if someone wants to say the LAO could be wrong or mm-hmm. the CBO can be wrong, that's certainly true.
Fair play.
The point is that we wanted a process by which the person who's going to be wrong is not a politician.
That's right.
It's supposed to be depoliticize it. This is not meant to create infallibility with the analysts who are dealing with totally fallible processes yes. around, you know, complicated moving parts. CBO gets stuff wrong. The LAO could get stuff wrong. I'm not even convinced the LAO is that nonpartisan, but they are slightly less partisan than the governor.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the process that they created.
Yes. So yeah, that's how you first do it. You cut the deficit almost in half with an act of more optimistic forecasting. CalMatters says, here's the challenge with that. This is a great line from CalMatters. Both the governor and the LAO predict large deficits of about $30 billion annually through 2028. So they disagree on this year's forecast, but boy, they both settle on about $30 billion annually for the next 4 years, David. Future deficits are likely to require the same difficult decisions like ongoing spending cuts and revenue increases. David Crane says, buried in the details is that the governor, because he has now raided the reserve fund, will actually produce, because of those ongoing deficits, will produce negative reserves. I don't believe I've ever heard this, but apparently what this means, David, you may know, a negative reserve means that you have borrowed more than is in the account and you now owe it back to the account.
Yeah, it's what Americans call Visa.
It's a credit card.
No, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you have $0 in savings, and can you turn my knob up there?
Yeah, with this one here?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. If you have $0 in savings and $25,000 on your Visa card, then you have negative reserves, right? But you did have access to the money. You got to spend
yes.
because the Visa gave you the spending power. So negative reserves is essentially spending on credit, right?
Yes.
Now, look, first of all, can I just point out, I became a pretty big student of the budget of California out of 2008 financial crisis. I was at Morgan Stanley at the time, and we had a significant position in California general obligation bonds. And there were three stakeholders involved in my research, Will. One of them is sort of connected to you, and that was the doom and gloomers on the right saying, see, now California's screwed. These, we're going to default. Everything's terrible. And I thought, okay, well, that could be true. But, you know, my doom and gloomers are usually wrong, so I want to know why they're wrong if they're wrong. The number two was just the most important interest was my clients who owned California general obligation bonds, and you had 5% coupon bonds that were trading from 100 cents in the dollar down to 80 cents. It's not really supposed to do that. Turned out to be some of the freest money ever made in history, because obviously those bonds not only went way back up to par value, but they also, interest rates dropped and you were locked in these 5% coupons. So those bonds ended up trading to 130 cents on the dollar. And I needed to make sure that I was making the right decision around holding certain California bonds that had never in history defaulted. But then the third was the other side that just said, yeah, it's fine. California can spend whatever and with impunity, it won't ever matter. And I thought, that doesn't seem right either. Will, you're looking, you sent me an article showing a $291.5 billion spending plan. When I was in the midst of doing all this research, the debate was between California's budget between $80 and $110 billion. Mm-hmm. We've tripled the top mm-hmm. line of the budget. Mm-hmm. We've tripled the top line of the budget in 15 years. That's just staggering.
Well, this is part of the problem, David, that, you know, the political spin here is predictable. You said a moment ago, you know, that Gavin Newsom is simply just an inveterate liar. He'll spin and lots of people will just accept it. Newsom says, hey, look, there's lots of great news here. Despite the downward revision in the forecast, last year's revenues are estimated to still be 23% higher than when I took office. 23% higher, David. The budget is 50% higher than when he took office. In other words, he has raised taxes, raised revenue, and he is still underwater. This is a guy who cannot paddle quickly enough upstream. He has created so much, what's the word I'm looking for? So many hurdles, so many obstacles, so many encumbrances to his own success. He also claims that no one could have predicted this revenue shortfall. David Crane, I should mention who David Crane is. He is the founder and head of Govern for California and a former Arnold Schwarzenegger finance analyst, teaches public finance at Stanford University. He's a very, very bright dude. He writes the explanation that nobody could have seen this coming. He says that excuse strains credulity. I'm going to read this entire paragraph because I think it's so valuable. That excuse strains credulity, given that anyone and everyone who pays capital gains taxes, presumably including the governor and lieutenant governor and their spouses, knew at the very beginning of 2023, much less by June, that their tax payments are going to be materially lower that year as a result of the 2022 stock market. It's hard not to conclude that willful ignorance played a role, just in time to hand out large salary and wage increases to political patrons as a part of that budget. And even if it didn't, what's the excuse for drawing on reserves absent a recession? And when the revenues Mr. Newsom forecast for the budget year are 50% higher than the revenues he inherited when he took office.
Yeah, there's another problem that I'm surprised our writer didn't focus on, which is if the was the stock market a California stock market?
No.
So how did other states that didn't receive the expected capital gain revenue not face the same issue? Why did we not have more states with bigger shortfalls?
Answer, please.
Well, the answer is that it's a disingenuous explanation. Now, by the way, I would say it's possible to have a regional recession. We had one in the mm-hmm. early 90s.
I remember.
And the aerospace layoffs and things, you can have that. And I would also add 2022 to some small degree. It wasn't a recession, and we shouldn't have these numbers, and the whole thing is a bunch of bunk. But it is true that the VC and technology impact and whatnot was stronger in California than other places. The part that where all this falls apart is that that's an excuse. This is what guys like me have been screaming about since the Gray Davis days. Why are we so reliant on one industry?
Mm-hmm. Because for tax revenue.
Texas was reliant on oil and gas forever, and they went and fixed it. Mm-hmm. They diversified the economy. They put a broad appeal to multiple sectors and industries. California has been top heavy around Silicon Valley since .com. And so you're going to say, well, yeah, I mean, we could have seen this coming. Who knew that if tech slowed down, we were going to be in trouble?
Yeah, right.
Like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. So I think it's sort of like saying, I didn't know I could get in a bad car accident if I'm driving the car at 90 miles an hour. No one told me that the damage would be worse. Like, they're driving recklessly. And then they're like, whoa, this is outside of our ability to...
You're making it very difficult to drink coffee this morning, man. Hey, he also promised no new taxes. But I just want to point out, this is, you know, just one of my pet peeves. This is a guy who has presided over two tax increases within the last year. Number one, he defaulted on the federal government's COVID loan by losing $33 billion and then not paying it back. Like the old Steve Martin argument, how do you make $1 million and pay no taxes? First, make $1 million. And then when the IRS shows up, tell him I forgot. It's a little like that. He did not pay back a federal loan of about $30 billion plus. And so automatically that triggers a hike in the federal payroll tax, which affects only California employers. We're the only state that did this. I tried to find any evidence that any other state failed to make these repayments. Only California did. That was Governor Newsom's choice to balance the budget this in 2023 by refusing to take $30 billion bucks out of the system and pay that money back. So he just saddled business with it. I talked to several business owners yesterday, each of whom told me, yes, their federal payroll taxes have indeed gone up. The other one, of course, is that the state income tax, highest marginal tax rate, went from 13.3 to 14.4% on January 1st. Governor Newsom signed that bill. So he is raising taxes left and right, but then comes out and declares, no, no, there will be no new tax increases. Done and done. Nobody that I could find in the mainstream media pointed either of those facts out, just giving him a pass.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, there's new laws for landlords in California. This out of the San Diego Tribune. 1 month security deposits are now the law. Limited credit checks and more. This is the this to me, David, is right up with the unintended but predictable consequences of government action. So the state legislature sent to Newsom. Newsom signed AB 12. Assembly Bill 12, and that limited security deposits to just the equivalent of 1 month of rental payments. That came because people who are renters' advocates and lefty progressives who believe in equity of all outcomes, equality of all outcomes, said it's not fair to charge people this much money to just get into an apartment. Security deposits cannot be that expensive. So we're now limited to just 1 month. The immediate guess here, I had a number of listeners who sent me this story, including one who said, first thing the landlords are going to do is just raise rents, right? That'll give you more money in the security. No, you don't think so.
No, it's more than that.
Tell me.
I do think so. First of all, for those of you that are able to tolerate David Bahnsen when he's not with Will Swaim, which is very, very few of you, and I'm probably one of them, I do have another podcast on National Review called Capitol Record, and we did a whole episode on this subject related to the NIMBYism and various challenges in the housing market. Why do we not have a greater supply of housing? And I used in the podcast Michael Dubb, who is a principal at Beechwood Homes in Long Island, New York. Their business has built over 10,000 homes over the last 40 years. And we had a big conversation about this whole topic. And one of the things he brought up was the regulatory apparatus, where things like limiting the security deposit issue is creating distortions in the market. And it is absolutely true that one of the things that could happen is raise the price of rent. But the other thing that could happen, when a landlord feels that they cannot mitigate the risk of a poor lender, is that they cannot rent to them.
That's right.
And I just want to go back to, like, when people say we need to not let people insure people for different risks, that, and they'll say, like, this, we're gonna have a regulatory thing that makes you insure people. And like, I'll have clients sometime, they'll come back and go, hey, this life insurance company turned me down, it's not fair. And I'll go, well, let me ask you a question. Do they want to insure you or not insure you? Like, what is the business an insurance company is in?
They want to insure that person.
To collect premiums or not? Because if the ideal is, look, whenever we insure someone, we got to pay out.
Right.
Well, we don't want to pay anybody out.
Right.
Let's just not insure anyone. That is a really bad business for an insurance company. They want to rent out to people.
Right.
That is the point of the rental real estate world. So if they have a reason to not do so, then there must be at least a prima facie question as to why. Why would they go against their own interest? And it obviously fits into the knowledge, the time and place circumstances, the history, them doing a risk-reward calculation based on a profit motive. And my belief that they're more qualified to do so than Gavin Newsom or a state legislator or whatnot. So this was a thoroughly discussed topic at that other podcast. I believe the episode with Michael Dubb aired sometime around the middle of December, if you're interested in checking that out. But the point I would want to make is that the unintended consequences are totally limited only by our own imagination. There are so many things that could be done in a regulatory context, a workaround, not renting at all, of course, raising prices. I'm going to mitigate the risk by just simply increasing the cost. You just don't, there's two things that have to be said, and the second one's more important. The first is you can't regulate this without an unintended consequence. The second is you don't need to. I want a renter. If I need 2 months deposit instead of 1 month to make me feel good about this, that's because I'm trying to get to a point of closing a transaction.
Right.
And there is a risk mitigation in the way. But this idea of limiting the security deposit, what would be a problem for a good, where do you go? Well, you're just picking on someone for no reason. You're making them do 2 months. Look, I don't pay security deposits anywhere. Because I just say, no, I'm not going to do it.
Right.
Here's our balance sheet. Here's the income. Here's the tax. I'm not going to pay you any if you don't want me, because I have that leverage, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. obviously the person has some reason they need a security deposit, and that because they're not dealing with a great position or great financial strength. But what they do have is other options. So the landlord is limited by the marketplace. Hey, come rent with us. We only take 6 months of your money that we're going to make dead money right. forever.
Yeah.
That's an unfriendly thing to do.
Yes.
And they're limited by market reality. And there, and so basically, this whole thing is a infuriating cause of the problem, not a solution to the problem.
Love that. Two other bills that, two new laws actually on January 1st that make this even worse for landlords. SB 567, that's Senate Bill 567, that limits the use of rental property by an owner's family. So if you own a piece of property and you decide that your kid, your ex-wife, your mother-in-law, somebody needs that property, you cannot rent to the family unless they sign up for a full year. The goal here is to make sure that the housing remains open for others who are not your family. The idea that you can just tell somebody you can't take care of your family except under these very limited restrictions is bizarre to me. Similarly, Senate Bill 267 limits credit checks. You're not allowed anymore to go check or under very strict circumstances, you're not allowed to run a credit check report on somebody to verify that they can rent your apartment and reasonably stay there and continue to pay and take care of the place. So I think the other unintended consequence here, and I think this is where you were headed, David, is simply that, people, who's going to invest in the apartment market here, the rental market here in California? Why would you do this? Why would you come into a place where you're being told you can't rent to your family, you can't check somebody's ability to pay, you can't require, can't hedge against the risk that they're going to drop out and just not pay you. These are real problems in the real world, and they do not serve anybody at all. I want to talk about a story very briefly that would seem only Orange County, and I hope our listeners will forgive us. So just bear with me, David. I wrote this piece in the Southern California News Group. That's LA, that's LA Daily News, Orange County Register, and et cetera. The headline for the story is California has real problems, so why is Senator Josh Newman meddling with the Orange County Board of Education? Here's what's going on, David. There is a bill right now pending. It's Senate Bill 907 from Josh Newman. Now, the state senator represents parts of L.A., San Bernardino, and Orange counties. But he's written this bill with all of the problems confronting California that our listeners are already familiar with. He's written a bill that would add 2 seats to the Orange County Board of Education. He says he's doing this because, of course, more government representatives means that they will have to represent fewer people, and that's good because it increases the proportionality, right? You have 5 members right now. He would have 7, and they would represent the same population, so each of those trustees would then represent fewer people and have better communication with them. All that sounds just reasonable and fine until you know that Josh Newman only raises this at a time when the conservatives control the school board and have now for about 3 cycles. That's untenable for Josh Newman, who gets buco bucks from teachers unions and Democratic parties outside the state to run this interference for teachers unions who are hoping that they can slice up the Orange County with more districts that will be will provide them with entree into the school board finally. He denies that that's true at all. I would just point out that he has made no similar claim about the problems of the County Board of Education in San Diego, which has a larger population and the same number of trustees we have here in Orange County, just 5. So I asked him, why not San Diego? And by the way, State Senator, why not look around your desk at the state legislature and reflect on the fact that you still have just 80 assembly members in the state legislature, still just 40 state senators, the same as we had in 1879, when the population of California was just a little bit under 900,000 people. So he says, well, that would be a real problem. Just try to get that passed. So this is really just him carrying water for the California Teachers Association, especially those unions down here that are just so frustrated. They need to pack the court, which is really what this is. You know, you can't win at the County Board of Education. And what has the County Board of Education in Orange County done that is so bad? It has enhanced. It has more than tripled the number of charter schools. It has allowed intra-district transfers of students.
But the charter schools is a bug, not a feature for them.
For them, it's terrible. Right. Yeah, they hate charter schools. Yeah. So everything this board has done, in fact, my name came back up because I proposed opening the schools in 2020, famously at a school board meeting back in April or May, I think, of 2020.
You know, Will, famously is kind of a relative.
Yeah. Famously in a small circle of people. Yeah, it was like being in an aquarium with a bunch of piranhas. They went nuts because all I said was, look, the evidence is in. The K-12 kids are not at risk from COVID. Let's
open
them
up. And then they said, you are an extremist.
Yes.
And you said, okay. And then who was that guy that was kind of a crazy on the COVID stuff? On the
board of trustees?
No. Oh. Like one of the big anti-COVID writers.
Oh, gosh.
Not like one of the good ones from Stanford and Harvard, mm-hmm. You know, Jay and all these guys, but Berenson, Alex Berenson. Mm. He's like probably the most famous one. Are you
sorry?
Sure?
Yeah, I don't pay attention to the crazy.
But what I was going
to
say is that you're not letting me get through my point. You don't know who Berenson is?
No. What, oh, is that your
this
point?
Guy's a lunatic. But all of Europe ended up agreeing with Will Swaib. All of Europe.
Yes. Yeah.
So like you're crazy, you want to reopen the schools. Like, yes. Also France. Like, isn't that a kind of a refutation?
It is. And I tried to point this out, that other, you know, entire nations and other states had decided that it was okay to send kids back to school. And now, of course, they claim that learning loss is a real problem and they have to have billions more to deal with the learning loss of the schools they closed. So my point with Josh Newman is simply that. And I do want to point out that one of my critics already noted that, you know, I say that he's backed by the teachers union, but they dared me to go find his money. And I said, oh, that's easy. The California Teachers Association and even unions down here have poured money into the accounts of three Democratic Central Committees. San Luis Obispo, Humboldt, and Santa Barbara gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to Josh Newman's campaign, even though they're nowhere close to L.A., Orange County, or San Bernardino. I want to repeat that. Hundreds of thousands of dollars came from the Democratic Central Committees of San Luis Obispo, Humboldt, and Santa Barbara to Josh Newman. Josh Newman got zip, or close to zip, a few hundred dollars, literally, from the Democratic Central Committees of his own counties he represents. He got nothing. Now, if this happened on the right, David, there would be hysteria in the mainstream press. There would be headlines about dark money flowing to candidates and campaigns. They don't like it when we turn the tables and tell them this is the dark money feature.
Yeah,
this is a dark money operation where you launder cash legally through other entities, and then those entities contribute on your behalf. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. So anyway, there's that story. I'll put it in the show notes. People can have a peep and make their own decisions. Meanwhile, in schools up in San Francisco, the school district is directing teachers to resources that condemn Israeli terrorism as worse than Hamas. This is from Haley Strack at our favorite National Review. In memos to social studies and ethnic studies departments discovered by Parents Defending Education, the district provided teachers with a host of resources to help lead classroom discussions on, quote, war, terrorism, colonization, and seeking peace. The first of the listed resources, Teach Mideast, it's called Teach Mideast, promotes multiple anti-Zionist articles and viewpoints, including an article published by Jerome Slater at the Middle East Policy Council. In the article, Slater blames Israel for Hamas violence and speculates that failed Palestinian resistance efforts have just made Palestinian terrorism the last resort of a noble people. David, so when we hear our friends, the teachers' union, say, my God, they just care about public schools and education, they really care about this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Let's wrap up, David, with one last story here, and that's from the LA Times. It's all over the place right now. The Supreme Court is going to rule on clearing homeless encampments in California and the West. So this is a fascinating story to me because it really is true that Democrat dominance of circuit of state courts here in California and more broadly in the Ninth Circuit have really made it difficult to eliminate homelessness. Gavin Newsom has kind of come around on this, and now the man who hates the quote Trump court, that's what he has called the Supreme Court when it makes decisions he doesn't like, is appealing to the Trump court to help unwind these bad decisions in the Ninth Circuit that will allow public officials to come in and clean up these places. Specifically, right now, the law, thanks to a couple of decisions, one is in Grants Pass, the other one was Boise, I want to say. In both cases, the Ninth Circuit said, hey, it is illegal, unconscionable, cruel and unusual punishment to tell people they can't sleep on public property if you're not also providing them with a place to stay. So the problem of me not having a place to stay tonight is now not my problem. It's now the government's problem. And Gavin Newsom even now sees the problems inherent in that decision and is fully backing the Supreme Court's review of these cases. So we've got here, here's the nut graph. California Governor Gavin Newsom and city attorneys from L.A., San Francisco, San Diego, and Phoenix were among 24 government and business groups that urged the high court to restore their authority over sidewalks and parks, or at least to clarify the law. They blame the Ninth Circuit, which is dominated by their own people, I want to point out, for the worsening homelessness crisis in West Coast states.
You've covered it all, my friend.
Thank you, buddy. Hey, we're going to have a couple of fun interviews coming up here. I'm going to talk to Jacob Hubert of Liberty Justice Center next week. That'll be part of our show. We'll just paste it in there. Jacob Hubert is the attorney representing Chino Valley School District in its case against Rob Bonta. There's lots there. And I'll be talking to John Cox about his new book on how to reform the state assembly. That's the problem I raised with Senator Josh Newman. I actually sent Josh a copy of John Cox's book and said, look, if you really want to reform something, reform yourself. A very Christian principle, I think. David, anything else you want to talk about?
You've covered a lot. We've covered a lot. I think that this was a really good episode, and I will miss doing this with you in person for a little bit here.
Me too, buddy. Yeah. But I'll come to New York if you like. That's all we have time today. That's all the time we have today. Thanks for spending your time with us. You can always find Radio Free California on the National Review website, but it's easier for you. I always say this, and I hope you're listening. It's easier for you and better for us if you subscribe and then rate and review the show. David, maybe we can come up with a book giveaway for the first X number of people who rate and review the show. And I love that you are always very libertarian in that. People don't have to review our show positively. You will still send them a book if they ask for it. What do you think?
I think that's a good idea.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about that in the next episode. That boosts our profile when you rate and review us, and that helps others find and join this little band of brothers and sisters. You can email us. Thank you to all of those who did. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to our session producers, Lucas Klaus, Brian Tong, who's sitting here right with us, Glenn Hall, and National Review podcast producer Sarah Schutte. Thanks also to Metalachi. That's the LA-based mariachi metal band you're going to hear in just 1 second. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima.